It's kind of funny.
Okay. The Interim House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Our first order of business, colleagues, is a work session for the introduction of pre-session committee bill drafts, and we'll open that work session now. Representative Berger is going to move these bill drafts one page at a time. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills for the 2015 session. Legislative concept 310, 311, 312, 314, 315, 316, 317, 319, 320, 321, 322, 323, 328, 329, 331, 332, 333, 334, 335-1, 345, 346, 347, 348, 349, 350, 351, 352, 354, 355, 356, 414, 416, 417, 889, 891, 892, 893, 894, 895, and 896.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the introduction of LCs 310, 311, 312, 314, 315, 316, 317, 319, 320, 321, 322, 323, 328, 329, 331, 332, 333, 334, 335-1, 345, 346, 347, 348, 349, 350, 351, 352, 354, 355, 356, 414, 416, 417, 889, 891, 892, 893, 894, 895, and 896. Before debate, let me simply remind the committee that these motions are considered in the same way that they were first introduced by Chair Lane Shetterly a number of years ago, in which the committee considers this motion and others like it to be a courtesy for bill introduction. It does not suggest that any member of the committee supports any of these bills or has any particular knowledge or understanding of them. It's a way of getting them into the process. If we vote on a bill, you will understand it because we'll take the time to make sure that everyone does. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion is adopted. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills for the 2015 session. Legislative concept 898, 899, 900, 902, 903, 1036, 1037, 1038, 1039, 1040, 1055, 1130, 1131, 1132, 1138, 1389, 1390, 1391, 1392, 1393, 1394, 1395, 1396, 1397, 1398, 1399, 1400, 1401, 1402, 1403, 1405, 1406, 1407, 1427, 1428, 1674, 1675, 1677, 1678, and 1679.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. 898, 899, 900, 902, 903, 1036, 1037, 1038, 1039, 1040, 1055, 1130, 1131, 1132, 1138, 1389, 1390, 1391, 1392, 1393, 1394, 1395, 1396, 1397, 1398, 1399, 1400, 1401, 1402, 1403, 1405, 1406, 1407, 1427, 1428, 1674, 1675, 1677, 1678, and 1679. With the understanding that I gave in connection with the earlier motion, is there any further discussion on this motion? Is there any objection to the adoption of the motion? Hearing none, the motion is adopted. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills for the 2015 session: LC 1680, 1681, 1682, 1683, 1684, 1685, 1686, 1687, 1688, 1694, 1806, 1807, 1824, 1828, 1835, 1836, 1988, 2024, 2029, 2031-2, 2031-1, 2031, 2038, 2039, 2040, 2041, 2046, 2072, 2110, 2201, 2268, 2277, 2312, 2371, 2390, 2398, 2461, 2469, 2565, 2603, and 2692.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the following LCs to be introduced as committee bills: 1680, 1681, 1682, 1683, 1684, 1685, 1686, 1687, 1688, 1692, 1692, but that was incorrect. It was actually 1694, 1806, 1807, 1824, 1828, 1835, 1836, 1988, 2024, 2029, 2031-2, 2031-1, 2031, 2038, 2039, 2040, 2041, 2046, 2072, 2110, 2201, 2268, 2277, 2312, 2371, 2390, 2398, 2461, 2469, 2565, 2603, and 2692. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion is passed and it's so ordered. Thank you, Representative Berger. Appreciate the help getting these bills introduced. As you can see, colleagues, we're going to have a fair number of pieces of legislation to work with when the committee meets in February. I should note that some of these bills will initially go to other committees before they come back here. All of them are related in some way to revenue or to the school or to finance or to the school funding formulas. I'm going to wait. I want to add at the end of the agenda, just for my personal satisfaction, comments from the committee, since some of us will not be here at our next meeting. And so we want to make sure that we don't miss that. But some of the people I want to talk about aren't here yet, so we'll hopefully they will come. And with that, we'll close the work session on bill introduction, and we'll open informational hearing on a tribal tax sovereignty. I'm reading the wrong one. 8:15, clean air tax feasibility study final report, and I see that our reporters are here. We'll open that hearing, and please come forward. Mazin? And Christine. All right.
Chair Von Hart, members of the committee, today we bring the final report to you. You have in your, first of all, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, just for the record. You have in your two documents. One would be the final report for Senate Bill 306. This is the bigger document, but 170 pages or so, and then you also would have the presentation that you would be seeing from the study team that we have coming through to us. The only thing that we have to mention that in Senate Bill 306 required the Legislative Revenue Office to look into the impact of a carbon tax or a clean air fee into how that would work. They had several types of requirements for the Legislative Revenue Office to look at. We contracted with the NERC, or the Northwest Economic Research Center in Portland State University. This work took the better part of about a year. They were very not only responsive and professional, and we kept putting all these things and requirements, and we promised, and we came a couple times in front of you, and promised that we would put a menu of options and menu of policy choices in front of you, and in order to be able to allow you to make any choices in case that becomes your choice of policy in the future. And therefore, that's the report that comes to you. It is big and voluminous because it had to take into consideration all the different types and issues and the type of what we would like to do, what happens under which circumstances, which scenarios, answers which questions, and so on. So because of that, we feel that this requirement in the Senate bill, we bring you the report that basically answers and complies with all these requirements. Most of the work was done as the bill requires on the 15th of November. However, it took all this time until probably the end of the day yesterday to make all the edits and dot the T's and cross the I's. Across the eyes and so on. So I think I'm going to get out of the way and allow this team that were really not only great and you know, and they're as smart as they come, and they were very responsive. They took all of our quirky requirements and demands and so on, and they were able to deal with them in a very professional way. And I have to mention before we give you the team that also our consultant the quality assurance Ed Waters have been very instrumental in all this work. So we have Tom Pitowski, who is the head of the center, and Jenny Liu and the rest of the team. Jeff and Chris and Andrew, and they will all come and present the presentation for you. So without further ado, unless you have any questions for me, considering the bill and what it required and why are we in front of you, I have to mention, Mr. Chair, that Representative Holby was the first one who asked me about a carbon tax price back in the 2007 session. So Representative Holby, this is your answer.
Well, yes, thank you very much. And let's hear from the reporters from Portland State. And Representative Holby, thank you very much for attending this committee meeting. It's rare to have you here, but a delight.
I'm patient.
And Representative Leininger as well. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But you got two that aren't.
Right. Just for our internet audience, while people are settling out, I'll say that we invited the other committee, which is has an interest in this topic, to sit with us, and a couple of the members actually did get up early to come and do that. And thank you very much for coming. Good morning.
All right. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Berger, members of the House Revenue Committee, and guests. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski. I'm director of the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University and also professor of economics. Let me jump. Oh, and with me today, I should add, now that I've got the screen right up in front of me, with me today is also Jeff Renfro, senior economist with NERC, Dr. Jenny Liu, the assistant director of NERC and assistant professor at Portland State University, Dr. Chris Butenhoff, assistant professor of physics at PSU, and Dr. Andrew Rice, associate professor of physics at PSU. We'd also like to thank who was involved in the research and writing of the report, Michael Pareskovich, who is sitting over here. All right, I'm going to give you a little background, although Mazen already filled you in. This is really a process where we came before you in March of 2013 and presented a study that we had previously conducted on the carbon tax and shift, which was a very broad sort of, I think, sort of the 100,000-foot level viewpoint of what a carbon tax and a shifting that tax back either through revenue neutrality, lowering corporate business taxes, business personal income taxes, and what the effects that might be. Consequently, Senate Bill 306 was passed and made effective in August. You did an RFP process. We were selected and really kicked things off in October 2013. And basically, over a year's time now, we've had various meetings. And what this list here in the green PowerPoints is really just to point out that this study was not done in a vacuum. We weren't just in the offices there with the computers and writing up and looking at numbers. We had monthly meetings with the LRO. We had a technical advisory committee meetings of various agencies around the state. That list, by the way, is given on page one of the report for that technical advisory committee. Many stakeholder groups from utilities, businesses, labor groups, advocacy groups from environmental to low income to business associations. We met quite often with all of these groups. And then we had updates to you and then started meeting even more regularly, almost weekly, with LRO staff as we're finishing up the study. And then, of course, we're here in front of you today. What I want to start off with is just there's many ways to limit carbon emissions. And what generally happens is that when you have something what we call an externality, is that when it has no price or no ownership to it, it tends to get overproduced or overused. And there are ways of trying to decrease this amount. One is through regulatory controls. You're familiar with the renewable portfolio standards, clean fuel programs, the energy siting standards for utilities that have been passed. These are very definite and pinpoint exactly what type of regulation you want and what type of or level of carbon emissions to have. Now, that's a little different, and we feel that those tend to not be as what we might call efficient as doing a market type approach. And there's two that we have listed up here, carbon cap and trade and the carbon tax. And both of these, in essence, try to put a price on carbon emissions, and so that people start to internalize that cost that's out there, rather than it just, in a sense, being free or the cost is just dissipated out to other people. It's right to where it is originating and is being used or consumed, so that incentives are put in place to try to change behavior, either through lower usage by more efficient ways, conservation, seeking alternative energy sources, investments in energy-saving technologies. And, by the way, and that this is efficient because we don't tell people how to find these ways of not using carbon content fuels, but they seek out the lowest cost ways of meeting and trying to, in a sense, avoid the carbon tax. So in that sense, it's efficient. rather than a regulatory, which may be set where people are required to reduce the carbon emission, and it may not be the least cost way of doing it. So, go ahead. So I want you to keep in mind, as we're going to have a lot of slides, a lot of information going on here, and very briefly, this is sort of the dynamics of this sort of triangle that we're looking at. What we're really looking at here is, you know, we're putting a carbon tax on, and we know that with that carbon tax, there will be revenues generated. There will also be impacts on the economy by people paying this higher tax. At the same time, what's done with those taxes? Are they used to lower corporate income taxes, lower personal income taxes? Are they provided back as a dividend to households? Are they used into the general fund? Are they used for targeted investments? All those aspects will have reactions back to the economy. So as we're looking at this process, you're sort of thinking about there's a carbon tax, there's a revenue, how is that revenue used, how does the economy react to that, and the way the economy reacts to it will also affect the amount of emissions that are there, which will affect the tax revenues, which will affect, once again, you have this sort of dynamic aspect at work. So that's sort of a very broad overview of how our analysis is done and what we look at. We look at taxes. Right. We look at what are the emission reductions. We look at what revenue is generated. We look at what are the economic impacts. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over, unless there's a question, to Dr. Liu.
Right. For the record, I am Jenny Liu, Portland State University faculty, as well as NERC assistant director. So we're going to jump right into our methodology and our modeling overview, and as you can see, it's slightly more complicated than the triangle picture that Tom had shown in the previous slide. So this high-level overview is already a simplification of the process that we went through in our modeling. So at the very beginning of our modeling process, we start with inputs into the whole system, namely a carbon tax that can be set at various levels per various dollars per metric ton of CO2 equivalents, and also energy forecast that comes from the Energy Information Administration modeling of what is our energy usage going forward, as well as what are the energy prices going forward. And this is customized and calibrated for our Pacific region, and we also further customize it using Oregon inputs. And all of this translates into fuel price increases in the system. And then those feed into our economy through the REMI model, which is the orange model that you see on here. And the REMI model is also customized for Oregon and takes all these inputs into six Oregon regions that we have divided up the regional geography here in Oregon. And what comes out of it is what happens to the economy. And also we can calculate from there what happens to emissions. So there below that REMI model, we see we model what happens to the emissions, and also we model what happens to the carbon tax revenues.
Just a moment, Representative Berger.
I have an overview question. You've immediately launched into, if I understand this particular piece, a tax on gasoline. Am I correct in that?
A tax on combustion that emits carbon.
Cars, okay. Are there other carbon-producing, in this report, which I admit I have not read, are there other, in Oregon, carbon-producing significant emission, you understand what I'm getting? Is there anything besides cars in Oregon that we're going to tax under this or proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, under this particular scheme, we are not only charging this tax or modeling a tax on gasoline, but we're modeling it on gasoline, we're modeling it on natural gas, we're modeling it on electricity that is being produced in the state, as well as electricity that is imported into the state. So basically, it covers all sources of fossil fuel combustion that happens in the state, in addition to electricity that is being brought in.
And what percentage is the combustion engine piece of that whole universe.
That comes up later in your report, doesn't it?
Does it?
Yes. There is a breakdown that comes a little later, so I will...
I'm early on this, but I'm going to have to leave, and I think it's the big enchilada, and I just want that on the record. That's all.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Please go ahead.
All right. Mr. Chair.
So,
Representative Benz, just a moment. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, just so I understand, is this, I was curious about the models because I don't understand them, so I pulled out some material on them, and I just want to know, is this a computable general equilibrium model, a CGE model? There's a bunch of models here, but is this what we're looking at now?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, yes.
Identify yourself for the record.
Sorry, for the record, I'm Jeff Renfro, Senior Economist with NERC. REMI is sort of the core of the modeling process. It is a CGE model, computable general equilibrium model. And the emissions model that we developed as part of this process uses REMI outputs as its inputs and then feeds back into the REMI model.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow up.
Please,
And this is just because I want the foundation for your discussion to be more clearly understood by me. And I was looking at this economic models and development economics article, and at the end they say, the gap between general theoretical principles, abstract selective implementation of these principles in a particular model, and net predictive consequences of the model is substantial. It's quite possible the predictions of the model will, of a model that is antecedently credible, will nonetheless be wide from the mark. So perhaps you can share with us at the very beginning how much weight we should put in that which you're about to share with us.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. It is a model. Jenny is going to talk in the next slide about the process we went through to make sure that the baseline matched actual Oregon conditions. So we actually worked with REMI to change the sort of out-of-the-box measurements of employment and output so that we were within a percentage point of actual output by industry here. And then also, we worked with Department of Energy, Department of Environmental Quality, Public Utility Commission to make sure that the energy inputs that we're feeding into the model actually reflected the real electricity generation and the actual use of natural gas, the actual use of gasoline here in Oregon. A model is a model, but we went through an extremely long process to make sure that this model in the baseline reflected reality in Oregon. And then what we use going forward are marginal differences from that baseline. So we're kicking that model, we're introducing shocks to the system, and we're deviating from our original baseline.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. So continuing with our modeling overview, after the tax revenues are calculated, then we take those revenues and we go through a whole bunch of revenue repatriation or expenditure, basically revenue usage scenarios that you see on the left-hand side of the model here. And that we will go into a lot of detail on what specific scenarios or the whole list of scenarios that we do cover. And all of that means that we recycle this revenue through the economy, and that causes dynamic effects to circulate throughout the economy through the REMI model. So out of all of this, what we're able to look at in the end is by region, by industry, and at different carbon tax levels into the future, we're able to see what happens to greenhouse gas emissions as a result of the carbon tax, as well as what happens to our Oregon economy through our look at its output, employment, wages, and other just revenue in general. All right, so it's important at the beginning to really establish a baseline, as Jeff was talking about, of both our economy as well as emissions, so that we know that we're comparing our modeling outputs to a baseline that actually matches what is going on here in Oregon. So our economic baseline includes all of these inputs that are customized for Oregon, namely what are the industries that we are operating in and what industries are we not operating in, namely perhaps the oil refinery business is not here in Oregon, for example. So all of these are based on a projection that we have policies in place and they're going to be extended into the future, and that forms our baseline. So we will show what we project to be a baseline of our economic growth in a little bit. And for emissions, kind of covering what Representative Bentz was or Representative Berger was asking earlier, is that we are modeling a carbon tax on energy-related fossil fuel combustion. And to start with our emissions baseline is based on the Oregon greenhouse gas inventory that was produced by DEQ as well as Department of Energy. So it covers all in-boundary natural gas and petroleum combustion that happens inside of the state. And then also for electricity, following the same greenhouse gas inventory, we're covering all electricity that is being produced here in the state, be it by coal or natural gas or wind, and also covers any electricity that is brought into the state and used in the state but is imported and produced elsewhere. And all of this is really trued up and calibrated according to what our actual emissions are in the state. So all of this is based on that very long process of trying to calibrate everything so that we start from a very solid baseline. So with that, I will pass on to Jeff.
Once we've shocked our model, right, and we've developed an updated estimate of emissions. We use those emissions to estimate the revenue collected, and then that revenue needs to be put back into the economy, right? So we do that through a process of repatriation and expenditure. Repatriation basically means we're lowering existing tax rates or eliminating fees. Expenditure is really anything else that the legislature would spend that money on. So we've grouped for convenience in explaining this, we've grouped our repatriation and expenditure scenarios into different categories. As a note in the report, Appendix 2, there's a much more detailed version of the schematic that we're showing you. So once the tax revenue is collected, there's a basic first decision that needs to be made. Is the government going to hold on to all of that revenue and use it for government purposes, or are they going to put it back into the economy? So our scenario A, and I'll give you examples of these on the next slide. Scenario A, we assume that the government holds on to all of the tax revenue collected and uses it for some sort of government purpose. If the decision is made to let that revenue back to the economy, we have scenario B, which is a truly revenue neutral scenario. So all of the revenue is used to cut existing personal and corporate income tax, and then all of the transportation revenue is used to offset existing transportation taxes and fees. This is a really key part of the report. Very early on in the process, we met with legislative counsel, and we asked about the issue of collecting carbon tax revenues on transportation fuels. We were told, with no ambiguity, that if you apply a carbon tax to transportation fuels, those need to go to the Highway Trust Fund. So we incorporated that into our modeling. So in that truly revenue-neutral scenario, we keep the transportation-related revenue separate from the general fossil fuel revenues, and all of those revenues are used to reduce existing transportation taxes and fees. So on the other side of that, if it's not truly revenue neutral, then it'll be partially revenue positive, or will be revenue positive, with some of the revenues being kept for other government purposes. So that brings us to the bottom left, which is the scenario group C. Both scenario group C and D, we assume that transportation revenues are given to the Highway Trust Fund, and then we're going to experiment with other uses of the revenues. Right? So in scenario C, we're saying that transportation revenues go to the Highway Trust Fund. The rest of the revenues are locally revenue neutral. So those revenues are used to offset existing corporate and personal income tax rates. We also have a citizen dividend scenario in there that I'll talk about in a second. In scenario D, we assume that transportation revenues go to the Highway Trust Fund. We assume that some of the remaining revenues used to offset existing personal and corporate income taxes. We also assume that there are other government priorities that the revenue is used for, and I'll talk about that on the next slide. Our last scenario grouping is scenario grouping E. We assume that those transportation revenues come in. We assume that they're used for transportation purposes, but we assume that the constitutional requirement is either relaxed or changes in some way. So we ran a few scenarios where we look at using that money for just other transportation purposes. So let me give you a few examples of each one of these. So our A scenario, which is the government holds on to all of the money, there's no repatriation or expenditure. We wanted to look at what would happen if all of the revenues were kept in a financial reserve. We don't think that this is very realistic, but we did this for a few different reasons. So if the revenues are collected and they're not put to some sort of productive use, they're stored away somewhere, this could resemble what would happen if the federal government imposed a carbon tax and used the revenues in a way that didn't directly benefit Oregon. Also, conceptually, from our perspective, using the revenues for sort of non-productive purposes or purposes that aren't directly benefiting the economy in real time, it also gives us a sense of what the impact of the front-end energy price increases are. So in a sense, we have a better idea of kind of the employment hole we need to dig ourselves out of with the repatriation and expenditure on the back end of the policy. The B scenarios, as I said, it's all just reduction in personal income, corporate income taxes, and then reductions in existing transportation fees and taxes. In the C scenarios, the one quirk we added to that is as we've been around the state talking about carbon taxes for a year and a half at this point, at just about every meeting we've gone to or every time we've talked to a public group, we get asked about this citizen dividend option. So we wanted to run some scenarios that looked at this. So this is basically adopting the Alaskan oil model. So we look at scenarios in which carbon taxes are collected or revenues are collected, and then they're distributed on a per capita basis in Oregon. Our D scenario, so this is, we wanted to look at specific policy priorities that the revenues could be used for. So we know that a tax on energy is going to be regressive. Lower income people spend a higher proportion of their income on energy related purchases. So we know that this tax, even with the repatriation and expenditure on the back end, if low-income people aren't targeted, then they're going to be negatively affected by the tax. So we wanted to look at strategies for offsetting that negative impact. And then we also wanted to look at specifically methods for assisting workers and industries that might be negatively impacted by the tax. We also wanted to look at targeted industry support. So we know that if the conversation about this tax gets serious, we know that probably every industry in Oregon is going to ask for an exemption. So we wanted to model what would happen if we exempt industries. And then we wanted to look at other methods for offsetting the negative impact on industries through targeted investment. We also looked at using some of the revenues for energy efficiency projects and the economic impacts associated with that. And then in the E scenarios, as I told you, we're using the transportation revenues for transportation-related purposes, but we're not assuming that all of it goes to the Highway Trust Fund. So some of the scenarios we looked at, the Highway Trust Fund revenues are distributed based on a weighted vehicle mile traveled formula. So we worked with the Department of Transportation. They gave us not a forecast, but an estimate of VMT distribution in the future. So basically, we unweighted their formula and looked at what would happen if we just distributed revenues based on a straight-ahead vehicle mile traveled. We also looked at investing in a variety of non-highway transportation funding. So this could be things like light rail expansion of public transportation.
Representative Berger.
But I did hear you say that the e-scenario would require a constitutional change because of the highway trust fund issue.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, we're not attorneys, but the attorneys we talked to led us to believe that. So we're going to start getting into the results, but I'm going to hand it off to Chris and Andrew to talk to you about emissions.
And before we launch right into that, just before we get into results, all of our forecasted results for emissions and the economy project from 2014 into the future for 20 years. So that's into 2034. And our tax rates that we modeled in our project go anywhere from a maximum of $10 per ton, per metric ton of CO2 equivalents, up to $150 per ton of CO2 equivalents. And I'll turn the table over to our physicists.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Butenhoff. I'm assistant professor, Department of Physics at Portland State University. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you. What myself and my colleague Andrew Rice, we're going to walk you through in the next couple slides will be our results for the emissions. And so the first slide that you see here, what we're going to show you, the baseline emissions. These would be the emissions for the baseline scenario, meaning under a no carbon tax future, and then we're going to show you the emissions from the various at the various carbon tax levels. And again, just going back to a previous question by Representative Berger, the emissions that we're talking about here are just the energy-related emissions. So if you look at the whole suite of Oregon State emissions, these energy-related emissions account for about 80% of the total state emissions. There are some emissions we're not accounting for. These would be, for example, from agriculture or some industrial processes, which are not considered to be energy-related. So these emissions are just from essentially fossil fuel combustion, either related to the burning of fuels for transportation, natural gas for heating, or for the production of electricity. And so
And in here somewhere is a breakdown between those?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, yes.
Thank you.
Yep. So the first thing we want to point out here is just the baseline. Members of the committee might be aware that Oregon does have this goal of reducing Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions 10% by the year 2020 and 75% by 2050. So we thought it would be useful to just put the 1990 reference here, which is the dotted line. Go ahead, show the baseline. So again, this is the baseline forecast. So this is, again, based upon fuel demand taken from the Oregon Department of Energy, and the U.S. DOE projections for the Pacific region. So under this scenario, under a no carbon tax scenario, we expect emissions to rise roughly 10% from the beginning of the modeling period. And I just want to point out that under this baseline scenario, this would reverse a current trend that we're seeing in Oregon. Roughly since about 2000, Oregon's emissions have been decreasing about 10%. So under this baseline scenario, this would get us farther away from the Oregon's emissions reductions goal. And so for the next set of emissions, go ahead and you can show those. So again, these are the emissions forecasts for the various carbon tax rates, starting at $10, $30, $45, $60, all the way up to $150. And just to point out that the carbon taxes are phased in at different rates. So the lower carbon tax rates, $10, $30, $45, those are being phased in at $5, starting at $5, and then being phased in $5 per year up until they reach the maximum target. And then the higher carbon taxes are being phased in at $10. So that explains some of the differences in the plots that you see. Another point I want to raise is obviously, depending upon how the revenue collected is returned, repatriated, or spent, will have a feedback on the economy, and that feedback on the economy will then determine the fuel demand, and that fuel demand then, of course, determines the emissions. We went through that exercise to see what the impact of that feedback is on emissions, and even kind of among the whole range, the minimum and the maximum scenarios, that difference in emissions is only about 1 to 1.5%. And so the emissions results that we're showing you are selected for the C4 scenario. This is the scenario where the constitutional requirement that the transportation fuel revenue is returned to the Highway Trust Fund, and then the rest of the revenue is split between 70 corporate, 30 personal. But in practice, the emissions for the elder scenarios will look nearly identical to these, but just to point that out.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Nels.
I got a little bit of a cold, so if you can't understand me, just let me know. Am I reading the chart correctly in that pretty much anything below that dotted line, we're actually achieving our carbon emission goals, and everything above that, we're not? Is that the way to read that?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nels, that's almost exactly right. If you want to be a little more specific, the goals are a 10% reduction by the year 2020.
Okay.
So that's achievable by $60 or higher.
Okay.
Up until $60, we don't quite reach that at 2020, but at 2020, we do reach that 10% reduction at that year.
So. I mean, it stands to reason the higher you raise it, the faster you're going to get it.
Absolutely.
But like, just doing $10 for or $10, for example, per ton doesn't get us anything.
That's exactly right. So at $10, we're still above 1990 levels.
Yep. Okay.
With the truck carbon tax above $10, then we start getting below 1990 levels. And once we reach $60, we do actually reach that 2020 target.
Okay. And then you're going to show what it does to the economy, right?
Like exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So this is just the emission. And again, the logic is simply that the emissions kind of feed into the revenue, then the revenues return. So we thought it would be a logically good place to start with our results.
Makes sense to me.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
I'm probably ahead in the questions, but mm-hmm. I do have to leave, and I'm wrapped in this discussion. You're talking about carbon $10 per ton of emission. Have you done an analysis of cost of compliance and cost of collection in this whole and how that would work? And is it in here?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Berger. So we did look at some of the mechanisms for collection, and for the most part, we are envisioning collection at a wholesale level, except for electricity, which would be collected at the consumer level. And most of our analysis is that we would envision lowest administrative costs associated with piggybacking on current activities that the government is engaging in terms of collection of any taxes or fees. But as we point out towards the end of our study is that the actual implementation requires more of a deeper study into the best practices that of actually implementing it at each agency level.
Thank you.
I would note, while we have a second, that several of the legislators will be leaving for other meetings at 9 o'clock and then coming back. This is not a reflection on your presentation.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
So just to finish up the slide, I just want to make a final note here that, again, our modeling period only goes up to 2034, and even under the most extreme carbon tax of 150, we're still only seeing about a 40% decrease relative to 1990 levels. So it would be more difficult to reach the more ambitious goal of a 75% reduction by 2050 with just a carbon tax alone. Next slide. And then this is just kind of a summary of the graph in the table. So again, what we're showing you here are the emissions for the baseline case, no carbon tax case, and the various tax levels. And then we're showing the numerical values for the reduction relative to the baseline. And again, in that second column, you can see for each of these different carbon tax levels, we see a reduction in emissions from the baseline anywhere from 7% to 42% or 43% for the highest tax case. And then the third column are the percent changes relative to the 1990 level. So hopefully this makes it clear that at the $10 level, again, we do not get below the 1990 level, but for carbon taxes above that, we do get below the 1990 level emissions targets. So with that, I will pass it on to Andrew.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrew Rice, Associate Professor of Physics at Portland State University. So some of the power of our approach is the breakout of emissions by region, by economic sector, by fuel type. This slide shows the breakdown of emissions by region of the state, and I'll refer you to the results section 2 also for this information. But the colors in the pie chart, which correspond to the colors in the region of the state, the map, we have 6 regions that we've modeled in this case. And for the baseline case, which is what we're looking at here, again, this is no carbon tax imposed, the projection, about 60%, a little more than 60% of state emissions come from the metro region. About 20% come from the valley region. The southwest contributes 7, the northwest 2, and the central 3.5, and eastern 4%. Okay, so the bulk of the emissions come from two geographical regions. And if we, the next one, there you go. Impact of the carbon tax on emissions, as you can see, as these new ones come up for the $30 per ton, the $60 per ton, the $100 per ton. You can bring this up. The impact on, is very similar across the regions of Oregon, and this is consistent with populations of the regions and industries and commercial activity. Again, the reductions here are 15% for the 30, 26% for the 60, and 35% for the $100 per ton, just from the last slide there. So you can see reductions occur across in all regions under these scenarios. Okay. The areas of the pie graphs up there are actually a relative size of the emissions also, just so you can see the shrinking pie overall. We do see a slight shift, so there's slightly larger fractional reductions in emissions in the metro region compared to the others. For example, in the baseline case, it represents 62% roughly of emissions. In the $100 per ton, it drops down to 59%. And this is due to industrial activity primarily, but also reductions in commercial and residential emissions. But this is a small effect overall, just a couple percent shift. Not shown in this slide, but also our model was able to break down by fuel and by sector. We do see the largest emissions reductions from the carbon tax in industrial sectors. This is largely in the natural gas fuel, but also electricity. We also see second largest is reductions in residential emissions. Within that category, petroleum emissions kind of dominate that. There's also more detail, as I pointed out, in the results section 2. Okay, should we move on to revenue?
Does that mean heating oil or something else?
Chair Bernhardt, it includes, actually, our petroleum does include heating oil for
right.
heating, yeah.
I mean, you were talking about residential, I think residential.
Correct.
Use. I'm
correct.
Assuming that's what you're talking about primarily.
The petroleum, Representative Bernhardt, excuse me, petroleum fuels includes both for automotive and for residential heating oil. It's dominated, the emissions reductions are actually dominated by the transportation.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you. And sure. Now I understand what you mean by the word residential.
My apologies.
No, Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I'm curious, when you're looking at emissions that are produced by generating electricity, do you treat electricity generated from methane from landfills, for example, different than any other because it's displacing already occurring methane? Mm-hmm.
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Holvey, we are not considering methane emissions from landfills. Those are non-combustion fossil fuel emissions. So we're really looking at about 80% of the statewide emissions. We are missing about, well, it's closer to 17% currently.
Your question is slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah. My question was, if we're producing electricity from that methane from a landfill, is that going to... Is that in your figures for being taxed under the carbon tax?
Sorry. Apologies, Chair Bernhardt, Representative Holvey. Yes, we're including the different mix from different electrical providers. So utilities have different fuel mixes, and we are considering in this study we went to a lot of effort, including data requests from the utilities themselves, to get at what the electrical mix was for each region of the state. So those are included.
So if we wanted to encourage the reduction of methane, we would simply leave them out of these approaches, in order to encourage the collection of the methane and the use of it in generating energy or for some other purpose. Mm.
Chair Bernhardt, that is correct. So,
but your projections included it in the approach that we're studying.
Right. Do you have it?
Representative Bernhardt, Yes. So the way that we modeled the impact on the price of electricity in the different regions is we, as Andrew said, we requested data from the utilities. We worked with Department of Energy, and we used the integrated resource plans. So we're looking at what the utilities say that they're going to do in the future. So if they plan to incorporate more of these non-fossil fuel combustion methods into their electricity generation, then from our perspective, it makes the carbon content of the electricity in a particular region go down, so we reduce the price impact. So it, ultimately, it's about reported carbon intensity of electricity generation by each utility. So that's how we would incorporate it into the process.
Thank you.
Okay.
Right. At this moment, let me just finish. I think Representative Holvey's where he's going. At this moment, the utilization of those kinds of energies is very, very small, isn't it? And whether we're talking about farmers using biodigesters or some kind of collection of methane at the landfill, those are tiny. They don't amount to anything in the grand scheme of things, do they, at this stage?
Chair Barnhart, they're small. That is correct.
Thanks.
They're small.
Please go ahead.
So if we just take a look at a carbon tax scenario revenue projections for the future here, again, to calculate this, and you can show the first the slides there. To calculate this, it's fairly straightforward to take the statewide emissions from the last couple slides and then to just put on top of that the carbon tax, which is collected. And so we have what we have is annual projection in the future based on that. And you can see two branches emerge in this projection. This is very similar to what we saw in emissions. And this is just that although the carbon tax is introduced at the same rate, it is increased differently in our different scenarios. So in the bottom three scenarios, it is increased at $5 per ton per year. In the top scenarios, 60 and above, it is increased at $10 per ton per year. So you see two branches emerge there. Just take a couple scenarios there. At $30 per ton, revenue stabilizes at about $1.4 billion. This is very similar to what BC is seeing in terms of returns on revenue on their $30 per ton tax, which is currently in place. At $60 per ton, the average revenue upon stability is about $2.4 billion, and then at $100 per ton, revenue is about $3.5 billion. If you break this down by sector, approximately 35% of the revenue is from the residential sector. The rest is split roughly evenly between the commercial and industrial sectors. I'd like to point out that once the carbon tax cap rate is kind of reached, revenue stabilizes for years thereafter within a few percent. And I'd just like to point out in the study that results section 3 has more detail on page 29 of the report, if you'd like more in detail about that.
All right, now so we launch into our economic impacts overall.
And I'm just going to go very quickly. You just had an update on the economic forecast from Mark McMullen and Josh Lehner. This is sort of the breakdown of employment in the pie chart. We have compensation here. And then, to keep in back of your mind as we're talking about revenue generations, annual state budget, one fiscal year, very generally with GF and lotteries, about $8.2 billion. And then what we want to show is, well, what are sort of, how can we frame all our scenarios? And one way of doing this is to say, well, what if we had a 100-ton financial reserve? Jeff mentioned that before about scenario A, where it's all put into a reserve and is not put back into the economy at all. Or as he said by analogy, that it would be like a federal tax and all the tax left the state and there were no returns back. So here, by the way, we have the baseline. And just as Jeff described, it's using the REMI models and so forth, very much calibrated to reflect what looks to be happening in Oregon. And as Representative Benz mentioned, it is a model and there is a forecast out for this baseline. And our what we're really concerned about is what are deviations from this baseline of instituting a carbon tax. So here is the line: if you had the $100 per ton price, and none of that revenue was brought back into the economy, and the other part is having the 30-ton all general fund, where every single dollar would be put right back into the economy and spent in back into the economy. And so we have a sort of this framing now of these kind of extremes. And the point here is that there's not a lot of movement. If we look at the scenario where all taxes, nothing goes back to the economy, it's averaging around towards the outer years about 35,000 jobs would we be down from the baseline. And that's a little over 1% drop. The other thing to keep in mind is notice this whole line is still going positive in the sense that even if we have sort of the worst scenario for implementation of a carbon tax, we're projecting that there would still be positive growth in the economy. That tax would just be a drag on that positive growth. And likewise, for spending all the money, we get about a 1% up in differences of jobs in that growth path from the baseline. So, point is, fairly narrow impacts, I think, economically, at least on jobs.
Representative Ellis, please.
Are you going to show a chart later which shows what happens to the economy if we do nothing about carbon?
The Paulson question.
Well, I Representative Barnhart, Representative Noss, essentially that's our baseline case where there is no carbon tax put in.
I think I'm asking.
He's asking a different question. No. What happens when the...
We're making an assumption here that here's what this does to the economy if we implement the tax, or if we don't, we put the money back. I think I'm asking a broader question, and if your report doesn't cover it, that's fine. It's just, you know, what happens to our economy if we do nothing about carbon? I guess it's kind of, you know, what I'm asking.
I think you're asking about weather effects, ocean levels, and those kinds of things, and what those effects would be on economic activity.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Noss, we did not explicitly view that. We do talk about it, you know, in our further research and aspects. But those are, you know, we didn't come into the study to identify the particular costs on human and things like that.
Makes sense.
Great.
And I'll turn this over to Jeff.
So I'm going to show you economic results in a little bit more detail. So the way that we're going to do this, in the report, we went through a lot of different scenarios. I'm just going to show you a few to give you a sense of what's in there, and we're going to show you a few that we think are representative of the overall trends. But in the report, in the results section, we have a narrative explaining all of this, and then Appendix 2 of our report is a detailed breakout of impacts on employment, output, compensation, and industries affected by the tax. So we're really just glossing over things right now.
Just a very quick clarification question on this slide: the emissions impact, is that relative to 1990 or the baseline or something else?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed, relative to the baseline.
Thank you.
So I'm going to show you on the next slide a job index that we created that's going to break out the employment impact in a way that's a little bit easier to read. But this slide, it explains roughly what's happening in each one of our scenario groupings. So generally, scenario group A, which is the financial reserve, but then it's also the putting all the revenue towards general fund, an expansion of the general fund. This is where we see our extremes that Tom just showed you relative to the baseline. At a loss of 37,000 jobs below the baseline, that is our most negative that we get here. And then our increase of 25,000 jobs above the baseline, you'll see on the $30 per ton column, that's as high above the baseline as we get. So we're operating within this range of about 1% above or below our forecasted baseline. As a general trend, the B scenarios, so those are the 100% revenue neutral scenarios, we tend to see small negative effects across our scenarios. That's in contrast to our C scenarios. C scenarios are, we're using the transportation revenues to, we're dedicating those to the Highway Trust Fund, and then the rest of the revenues are being used to reduce personal and corporate income taxes. We see the opposite there. We tend to see a small positive effect. I'll go more into that when I show you some slides that show that in more detail. Scenario Group D, targeted investment is generally associated with positive economic impacts, and that's due to the fact that we're identifying where we see the problems after the tax is implemented, and we're using the revenue to try to fix some of those problems or offset the negative impact. And then Scenario Group D, we see very little deviation from the baseline generally. So let me show you these results in a little bit more detail.
Let me interrupt just for a second. We have a very packed agenda this morning. I'd really like to spend another 3 hours on this, but we only have about 10 minutes.
Oh,
okay.
Shoot.
Wow. That's also a wide range, Mr. Chair.
We will be done in 10 minutes. We'll go fast.
Thank you.
We created a jobs index to be able to compare the scenarios a little bit better. So this represents number of jobs generated per $1 million of revenue collected. I wouldn't look at this as a measure of how productive or how good each scenario is. We just wanted to kind of normalize everything so we could talk about it easier. So as I said, you can see the B scenarios are generally a little bit negative. Our C scenarios, which are the Highway Fund and revenue neutrality, generally a little bit positive. Those negative C scenarios you see there, C630, C660, those are our citizen dividend examples. So we see a very, very small negative impact associated with that. I want to point out the one negative you see on the right side there, that D.1.4.1.60, that is our exemption of key industries. So what we find is that, and we go into this in much, much more detail in the report, but we find exempting industries versus applying the tax to industries and then trying to use investment funds to offset that negative impact. In both cases, the targeted industries are left harmless, but in the case where you have exemptions, we actually see negative overall economic impacts. And it's due to the fact that if you're exempting industries, you're just not collecting as much of that carbon tax revenue, which is then used to offset the negative impacts of the price increase. I'll try to finish quickly, so if we want to talk about that more, we can. We go into it in great detail in the report. If you want to go to the next one. This is our truly revenue neutral scenario. So we're using all of the revenues here to offset existing transportation taxes and fees, and we're also dedicating 70% of the remaining revenues to reducing corporate income taxes and 30% to reducing personal income taxes. We chose this one. It's sort of representative of the results we see in this section, but we have different mixes of tax cuts in the report. So generally what we see in a lot of these is there's an initial positive employment impact associated with implementing the carbon tax. We think this is due to the fact that when energy prices increase, there's an initial push to invest in alternative production methods, right? So if your inputs are changing, you're going to change your production method. So there's an initial investment. There's also in some industries, the price of capital relative to the price of labor is changing. So some industries, it makes more sense to hire people rather than to run machines. And that's a big oversimplification, but that's generally the trend that we see here. Eventually, what happens is after that initial investment push in response to higher energy prices, we see people sort of living and coming to a new equilibrium at these higher energy prices. So in this case, we see everything evening out at levels below the baseline. And as a note, as Tom said, we're still experiencing growth. In this case, the carbon tax is just acting as a drag on this growth. So this is the employment impacts broken down by region. This is very representative of what we see. Generally, the Portland metro area has negative impacts. In just about every scenario we look at, there are small negative impacts. It's less than 1% of employment in the Portland metro region, but it is usually negative in our scenarios. This is due to the industry mix in Portland. Some of the negatively affected industries are grouped here, are grouped in Portland. Portland is also close to a border, so we see the negative economic impact of some of this leakage across the border.
And you're assuming no a policy change in Washington?
Representative Barnhart, correct.
Right. Of course, that may or may not happen. We don't know.
Right.
Thank you.
Generally, we see very small impacts on output. It's mostly negative in the scenarios we look at, even when we have positive employment impacts, but it tends to be very close to our baseline. And then for each scenario that we look at in the report in the second appendix, we have a breakout of the top 10 most positively affected industries and then the bottom 10 most negatively affected industries of each scenario we look at. Generally, the pattern that we see it tends to be the industries that you would think of as being involved in that initial investment push in response to higher energy prices. The construction industry is really going to drive what the overall results that we see, and in the next scenario I show you, I'll explain why that happens. But generally, the negatively affected industries that we see, I would group them into two categories. The small negative impacts are usually associated with industries that you would think of like high energy intensity industries. I'm going to show you Business Oregon's key industries, what happens to them in the next slide. But we see small impacts on things like high tech, advanced manufacturing, stuff like that. We tend to see the bigger negative impacts in the service industry. So if you look through our second appendix and you look at these tables, generally healthcare, food services, other types of service industries we see towards the bottom. It's generally a small effect, but they're grouped at the bottom. This is due to the fact that a lot of these industries are at the end of the supply chain. So in this study, we've incorporated all of the past price ons to the economy. At some point, the industry is not able, industry is not going to be able to pass those prices on. So service industries tend to get stuck with the bill in this. SB 306 directed us to work with the Oregon Business Development Commission. They gave us a list of industries that they wanted to they wanted us to pay particular attention to. So those are their outdoor gear and activewear, advanced manufacturing, high tech, forestry and wood products, and clean tech sectors. So ignore wholesale trade and clean tech for a second. That requires a little bit more explanation. But generally, we see very small impacts in these industries. Forestry and wood products, depending on our scenario, is either slightly positive or slightly negative. The other three key industries tend to be very, very small negatives. If you get into the data, I mean, it tends to be single or double-digit employment declines. We took wholesale trade out and made that its own category because wholesale trade is consistently negatively affected by the carbon tax scenarios, and it's a piece of all four of these industries. So we wanted to take that out to show you kind of what was really happening here. And then clean tech is strange just because the definition of what clean tech is not as developed as some of these other industries. So as an example, the official definition of clean tech includes the construction industry. We know that parts of the construction industry are operating in a way that you would describe as clean tech, but us and the Oregon Business Development Commission, we don't actually have a good idea of how much of the industry is actually involved in that activity. So our clean tech category, it features a lot of overlap with the other industries. There's some kind of strange stuff happening in there, and it's really being driven by a couple of industries, construction or some types of scientific and consulting services. So this isn't actually telling you much about clean tech. It's telling you about the industries that we define as clean tech, which frankly needs to be improved, or more studies needed to really get at what we want to get at here. Yeah. I'm going to just show you the employment impacts because we're almost out of time for this next one. So this is a really important effect we see. So this is moving on to the C scenarios. So in the C scenarios, we are using transportation revenues to top up the highway trust fund. What we see is that that is, in effect, a large public works project around the state. So what ends up happening here is, actually, do you want to go to the next one? What ends up happening is when you dedicate all of the revenue to sort of income support or tax cuts, what ends up happening is so Oregonians or businesses, they get additional income. They a lot of the time that turns into consumption. Oregonians tend to consume things that are made outside of Oregon, right? So there's economic leakage associated with that. If we take some of the carbon tax revenue and we dedicate it to large public projects here in Oregon, we're eliminating some of that leakage. So we see consistently positive economic impacts associated with increasing highway trust fund revenues. And this is due to the fact that it's basically construction jobs around the state. One thing that we see is the Portland Metro is still negative, so the construction boom in Portland is not enough to offset the negative impacts we see in other industries. But for the other parts of the state, we see a nice little bump in construction employment. I think that's good for this one. Do you want to just skip? And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jenny. Thanks.
So really quickly, this was one part that we spent a lot of time on, which was we were directed by SB 306 to look at existing Oregon laws that may interact with the carbon tax. And of the list of all the Oregon statutes, we were able to group them into these three larger categories. So the Renewable Portfolio Standard, motor vehicle emissions standards, various different ones under there, and then various regulations having to do with electric utilities. And you'll find this in a very large section of our report under evaluation of carbon tax relative to existing Oregon laws for the full analysis. But as a summary, what we found was that all of these various regulations that are already existing, and some of them are implemented, some of them are not, here in Oregon, they mostly have purposes or goals and objectives that are not exactly the same as a carbon tax, although they might introduce results that also reduce greenhouse gas emissions kind of as a byproduct. They don't specifically target greenhouse gas emissions as the carbon tax does. And for the most part, what we saw was that the interaction is likely complementary for most of these scenarios and all can contribute towards getting to the same goal, but they're starting point is really inherently different.
And I would, I'm sorry to force the time, but I would love if you could give us your conclusions and wrap up at this moment. I think that you've done a great job with the presentation. We have a very long report. I'm going to ask the committee members to study it pretty carefully, and given what you've described so far, they can learn about the other scenarios in ways. I have to tell you that, just very quickly, that I've seen applications of this report that go way beyond the question of whether we do a carbon tax or not, because it helps us to understand how the economy works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Please go ahead.
All right, so if you read the report, there are we further discuss all the other considerations that are listed here, as well as further research that we think will be important in trying to answer a lot of the questions that weren't answered in this particular report. But we will jump into conclusions here.
All right, I'll be very, very brief. You know, right here, just there's significant emission impacts from having a carbon tax, and there's revenue generating potential from doing that aspect. We've shown you that the economic impacts are small relative to the broader economy, but that doesn't mean you also need to take a look at the different regions, the different income areas, the different industries will have different impacts based on the carbon tax that's set. And then it's possible to offset the negative impacts. Very, very briefly, what we're trying to say is that, you know, the design of the carbon tax is very, very important. And we try to look at what we call the two E's. The first E is that besides getting your goal of whatever emissions you want reduced, you want efficiency. And by putting a price on the carbon content, we do get people to pursue the lowest cost way of reaching those goals. And then the other E is equity. What about the fairness of this? And there are ways to do that, either through low-income provisions, targeted investments and expenditures for businesses and households. And we think that you can, through the proper design, attain these two E's, efficiency and equity, and reach your goals of carbon reduction with really not harming the economy.
Thank you. Any final questions for the panel? I have one. Representative Noss has already raised the issue of the effects of additional global climate change that you've not considered, because, of course, you really can't in this kind of a report. I'm wondering about the effects, if you consider the effects of technological change, for example, improvements in solar and wind generation, electric vehicles, improvements in building design and construction, all of those things, and whether those have been considered in your economic impacts, and also in the issue of what kind of carbon reductions you can get using these scenarios. Have you hit those, or are those
we're thinking
not,
about?
Not part of the report.
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, so the energy price forecast that we use, the EIA's extended policy forecast, does incorporate what they think are reasonable expectations about that stuff going forward into the future. If there's a 20 years from now, a big game-changing sort of singular improvement, that wouldn't be included. But we do get into, I believe it's Appendix 4, we collected, during this process, we collected a lot of data from energy efficiency programs, and we break out how, you know, dollars invested corresponds to emissions reductions. So that information is in there.
Thank you. I would simply note that that particular organization's conclusions have in the past been pessimistic. So if anything, we probably will do better than what they've suggested, is my guess. And I'm getting head nods from the physicists, so appreciate that. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I'm sorry we don't have more time today. And we're going to close the information hearing now and move on to the information hearing on tribal tax sovereignty issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll ask Christine to come up. But I did want to mention that for some reason, some of our hard copies did leave out this segment, but it's in our official version of the agenda. So,
okay.
I just want to say people are confused by that. The tribal tax sovereignty issues is on our official agenda.
Right. This was posted on December 3rd at 10:34 in the morning.
Yes.
Yeah. So, those who are here for the tribal tax sovereignty issues, and Justin, I think, and perhaps some others. Thank you very much for waiting this morning. Appreciate it.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Berger, members of the committee, today we have an exhibit on the issue of tribal tax sovereignty. And there's a number of people here to talk about it. John Phillips at the Department of Revenue, Justin Martin, who works for the Grand Ronde, Catherine Brigham from the Umatilla Tribes, and Howie Arnett, who is the Warm Springs Legal Counsel, are here today to talk about some of the issues and a legislative concept having to do with the sovereignty of the tribal lands in Oregon.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share information with you today, and we look forward to working on legislation in the 2015 session. This concept has been worked on by all nine tribes during the interim, several meetings with the Department of Revenue, the Association of Oregon County Assessors, as well as the Association of Oregon Counties. With me today, I'm very proud to be sitting up here with Catherine Brigham, an elected official from the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and Howard Arnett, not just a brilliant attorney, but a professor at the University of Oregon, and very knowledgeable in these areas. I probably
that adds considerably to his credibility. Thank you.
I'll qualify that.
As I've been working with the tribes for 18 years, I probably sound like a broken record. You guys have heard this many a time, but Oregon really is a unique place when it comes to government-to-government relationships and the relationships between the state and the tribe. And I think as Oregonians, it's something that we can all be very, very proud of and look at our accomplishments and realize by working together, we really eliminate problems in the future. And this concept that you're going to hear about today does exactly that. This legislation will clarify in statute current Oregon practices that tribal governments are the sole entity with the authority to tax real property improvements on tribal trust land. It corresponds with the Ninth Circuit Court ruling in Chehalis Tribes v. Thurston County and the subsequent Washington Department of Revenue ruling to comply with the law applicable to this issue. This concept is important to Oregon's nine tribal governments because, one, it provides clarity in statute to existing practices. It will be revenue neutral. Two, it will promote economic development for the tribes because they can provide legal certainty to outside businesses on what entities can tax them. And then three, in keeping with the longstanding tradition that I just mentioned, we can continue to build on solid government-to-government communication and cooperation and coming together to craft solutions to avoid costly litigation in the future. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to the authorities here, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Good morning. I've never been called an authority before. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Catherine, but I go by Cat, and I'm an elected official for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I am the secretary on our governing body, which is the Board of Trustees. The Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla tribes are sovereign nations, and in 1855, we entered it into a treaty with the U.S. government. Under that treaty, we gave up 6.4 million acres of land to the United States, while reserving our sovereignty for the next seven generations and beyond. In addition, we also reserved our permanent homeland known as the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which we call CTUIR, located in northeastern Oregon. We have a long relationship with the federal government because they accept and recognize us as a federally recognized tribal government. Our tribal government has enacted dozens of tribal laws and annual work plans that provide services for education, public safety, water management, land use, housing, social, and an independent or economic development and an independent judiciary system for our reservation. It's important for you to know that not all of these services are limited to tribal members. These funds for these services come from a number of different areas, federal funds through compacts and grants, through tribal funds, through tribal tax and other grants, and if needed, we also do intergovernmental agreements. The state of Oregon has long recognized the government status of the tribes through the 1975 executive order. In state statutes and in government and intergovernmental agreements. The nine tribes of Oregon and Oregon departments have reached agreements and continue to work on issues because we believe the relationships maximizes our governance and policy development. In the spirit of these goals, we have worked with the eight tribes of Oregon for 2 years with the Department of Revenue, County Assessors, and the Governor's Office to develop the legislation presented today. This legislation is important to us and the other eight tribes for these reasons. It will promote economic development in Indian country by providing certainty. In 2012, Oregon tribes stimulated over $1.5 billion in economic output statewide, supporting a total of 13,153 jobs and nearly $507 million in wages and benefits. Speaking just about CTUIR, we are the largest employer in the Umatilla County, employing over 1,750 people. Over 60% of these employees are non-Indians. Currently, the CTUIR is not able to give possible business enterprise any certainty on tribal tax, on tribal land tax, on who will tax them. We can tell them what has been done in the past, and that is Umatilla County has not taxed businesses on tribal trust land. But there is no state law in place to point out to provide the certainty. We and other tribes like Warm Springs have lost out on business opportunity because of this uncertainty. The U.S. Ninth Circuit court ruling has created the incentive to get this clarified. The legislative concept provides protects our authority over tribal trust land from it being taxed by outside jurisdiction. As I mentioned earlier, tribal governments pay for services through taxes and other resources. CTUAR may not pay tax like local, or may not tax as other local and county governments do, but it is an exercise of sovereignty that we reserved in our 1855 treaty. Currently, we, just like any other government, can create intergovernmental agreements to provide services that we are not currently provided. We are really pleased with those who worked with us on this legislation. We not only listened to each other, but we grew to respect each other's interest. This is an important product of good governance, compliance with the law, and a strong government-to-government relationship. Thank you to the 8 tribes, the state, and the local governments for their work to prepare this bill through the government-to-government process and moving this legislation forward. And thank you for this, for your time, for hearing our views. And I will turn it over to the professor here. How we are that. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Howard Arnett, as Justin introduced me. My primary job, my real job, is tribal attorney for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. And I do teach law school courses on Indian law at the U of O Law School, but as an adjunct professor, and if you ever have been around a university, you know adjunct professors are not real professors, and I don't get a parking place or hardly any pay either, for that matter, but that's another story. But in any event, I'd like to talk a little bit about the legislative concept and the origins of the legislative concept. This legislative concept is really grew out of probably 3 different developments. The first was 2 years ago, the Bureau of Indian Affairs issued new regulations governing the leases of tribal trust land. And tribal trust land, as you may or may not know, is land within Indian reservations, sometimes outside of reservations, but the title to the land is actually in the name of the United States. And the United States holds the title to that land as trustee for the benefit usually of a tribal government, but sometimes of individual tribal members. And trust land has certain unique characteristics to it, one of which it's not taxable under federal law. And actually, state law in Oregon has recognized that, and if a tribe under state law applies to take land into trust, state law now says in Oregon that that land is not taxable while the process of completing the application to have land taken to trust is under advisement by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So it's been state policy in Oregon for many years to promote tribal economic development and improve the opportunity for tribes to take land into trust and increase their land holdings and their reservation lands. The second development, and this is probably the principal motivating factor for this legislative concept, was a landmark decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last year in a case involving the Chehalis tribe up in Washington and Thurston County, which is Olympia, Washington, and the Chehalis Reservation, and this particular facility called the Great Wolf Lodge that's on tribal trust land. If you've ever driven up Interstate 5 or if you have grandkids, you probably know all about the Great Wolf Lodge. It's on the west side of the highway, just north of Centralia. It's on tribal trust land. It's a large water park, hotel, convention center complex. And the facility is operated by a tribal enterprise, which is actually a joint venture, a majority ownership held by the Chehalis tribe with a non-Indian developer, which is the Great Wolf Lodge. It's a chain of water parks around the country. And after that facility was built, Thurston County recognized that the trust land, the dirt under the Great Wolf Lodge, wasn't taxable under federal law, but they believed that the improvements, permanent improvements, the foundation, the hotel, the water park, the convention center, all one big structure, was taxable. It was something separate from the realty itself, the trust land itself. And also because they said, well, it's not really the tribe that's operating this. It's a tribal enterprise, a tribal entity, a joint venture with this non-Indian developer. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that's wrong. that permanent improvements are part of the realty. They're part of the real estate, and the real estate itself is trust land, and trust land is not taxable. Therefore, the permanent improvements, the convention center, the water park, the hotel, are also tax exempt. And it doesn't matter that the tribe is operating that facility through a joint venture enterprise with a non-Indian developer rather than as a tribal government, it's still tax exempt because it's part of the realty, and the realty itself is not taxable. That's a fairly straightforward legal ruling, and we thought it was appropriate for Oregon to comply with that through a statute. And Oregon's done that in the past regarding other Supreme Court decisions and court decisions that are related to tax issues involving tribal members, such as the income tax exemption that Oregon statutes recognize, which follows a Supreme Court decision from the early 1970s. And that's what we propose with this. And when Catherine was talking about trying to achieve some sort of certainty if tribes are engaged in conversations with developers about tax aspects of a proposed development, simply telling a developer, well, there's this great Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, which applies in Oregon because we're part of the Ninth Circuit, you don't need to worry about being subject to any state or local taxes on any permanent improvements that you may have some equity in because the Ninth Circuit has said it's not taxable. That's usually not good enough for the developers. They say, well, we're going to have to litigate that in all probability if somebody wants to challenge it. A state statute recognizing the effectiveness of the Chehalis ruling would make it clear that doesn't need to be litigated. There's a statute on the books. That is certainty. The statute provides the certainty. And this really doesn't change anything. So far as we can tell, there is no currently assessed tax imposed on permanent improvements on trust land in Indian country in Oregon, so that the revenue impact of this legislation would be zero. And it only affects property taxes, taxes on the realty and its permanent improvements itself. It doesn't affect centrally assessed taxation, leasehold interest taxes, other kinds of taxes that are tangentially related to the property but not on the property itself. This is on the property itself and the real improvements to the property. So we urge the committee to give careful consideration to this legislation when it is introduced in the next session, and we're happy to answer any questions, Mayor.
Thank you very much. I'll note for the committee that we're talking about LC 417.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And you could look at it. I've read it. It's a very, very simple bill. Mm-hmm. Any questions? We very much appreciate your testimony, and I will let you tell you that I have also served as an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon. I understand the points you're making. It's still kind of fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else to be heard on this presentation? Thank you. We'll. There is? There is not.
Okay.
Oh, John. Yes, thank you. You'll be quick.
I'm very quick. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. I was asked just to come up and talk about the fact that we were included in the work group. We have had discussions. We have pointed out issues regarding administrative concerns about it, and the tribes have been very receptive. So we look forward to the discussion during session, and we are neutral on the policy, but we always like to weigh in on the administrative aspects to make sure the assessors in the various counties can manage the exemption. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you tell us what ORS 308.505 to 308.665, the things that are not covered by this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, that section of law is the Central Assessment Statutes.
Okay.
That's the law that you're very familiar with.
Yes. Unfortunately, we are more familiar with it than we want to be. Other questions for John? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the information hearing on tribal tax sovereignty issues and open information hearing on options for addressing falling take-home pay as gross income rises. From the Governor's Office and Legislative Revenue Office.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for the title, but it's hard to come up with a short title for it.
It's always great when Vince Porter comes to before the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Vince Porter. I'm the Governor's Economy and Jobs Policy Advisor. Thank you for giving us a little bit of time to talk about one of the elements that was in the Governor's budget relating to, basically this long-winded statement is something we also like to call make work pay. You know, the governor, as we've been looking at the issue on a few, on sort of the lower end of the wage scale, some of the issues that pop up, one that struck us as rather concerning, I guess, is that as you can see in this chart that Paul has provided for us, that essentially people in Oregon, as they're moving up the wage scale from $9.10 an hour to all the way up to even $17.10 an hour, if you take a holistic look at what their take-home pay, including their benefits, they actually, as they make more money, are coming back with less or considerably less than you would expect of their take-home pay. In the governor's budget, we did recommend the extension of some tax credits that are in up for sunset that address a few of these items, but don't really necessarily address this most concerning issue. Those include the working family tax credit is in recommended for extension, as well as the individual development account. But what we wanted to propose, and we've currently have it in the form of a task force bill, which is legislative concept 753, is finding a way to essentially smooth out this benefit cliff that happens as people move up the pay scale, and essentially giving them somewhat of an incentive. If you can, I think the one that we were most struck with is that if you look at, you actually can come home with more money in your pocket at making $9.10 an hour than you can at $13.10 an hour. So what we've been working with Paul on is some sort of scenario that smooths that benefit cliff. And right now we think that the best way to look at that is providing some sort of additional benefit for those who qualify for the working family tax credit, in addition to what they get. And our proposal is, we've been talking and working with Paul quite a bit, but our proposal is that we would provide a 5% tax credit on adjusted gross income. Now, I'm not sure we've figured that out perfectly. I think we purposely have left the concept in as a task force bill because we'd love to work with members of this committee and also the Senate Revenue Committee to really look and dive deep and make sure that we're providing the most effective solution to this issue. But I think one thing that we would love to see is a scenario in Oregon where the more money you make, the more money you take home in your pocket, and you're not penalized for earning more per hourly income. Paul, I don't know if you want to maybe discuss any of the technicalities of the data you dug up, but be happy to have you take it over.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I'll just say that this issue was probably the issue that the 97 Senate Revenue Committee spent its most time on, and really that was the first time I really focused on it. Result of that was the earned income tax credit of the 5% Oregon piece at that time was approved, and also the working family credit. Both of those became refundable in the early 2000s as again an attempt to deal with this, but I don't think we've really taken a detailed look at this issue since that time. So we've been working with Vince in the governor's office and looking at some of these options. And basically what this shows here is you have to be working family credit eligible. Now, the working family credit is based on child care expenses, and that's a major element in this, obviously, in that in terms of the costs associated with going to work. So, but the idea here would be that would limit the group. You have to be working family credit eligible, but then the calculation of the credit would be completely separate. It would be unrelated to daycare. It would be 5% of your adjusted gross income. And you can see the idea is to try to get at that middle range there. We don't quite hit it with a 5%, but we're pretty close in terms of at least holding that person even. And then, you know, it's not until you get to about $15 that you begin to see a significant increase. At that point, the idea would be to cap the credit itself at $1,200 and then begin to phase it out. once you get to $15. So the one caution I would emphasize in working with this, and Chris and I have been working on this for a while, the best way to look at it, I think, is to look at particular examples, and that's what we've done. This is the examples we have here is a three-person family, two dependents, and one adult. But remember, there's a lot of different scenarios, so we have to make sure that you know how you structure this is going to be flexible and enough to deal with a number of different scenarios. So, and we've also had some discussions with the Department of Revenue about implementation and issues around compliance and so forth. So this is something we spent some time on, prepared to work further with you on.
And Chair Barnhart, if I could say, I mean, I think it was important. We thought this issue was important enough bringing up in the governor's budget. This one in particular, because it's somewhat of a newer concept. We understand and appreciate that there are probably multiple tools to measure and address this issue. But we didn't think that this one was currently in existence, and that was the main reason why we highlighted it in the governor's budget.
Okay. Questions? Comments? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I came in late. I was in front of another committee, but I just wanted to thank you and you for testifying on this subject today. I was a part of a work group this past summer on the ERDC, and one of the things that we talked about was how when somebody finds employment or gets above the benefit level, that they have the cliff effect on those benefits and how devastating it can be, both for the parents but also for the children who are in the child care program. So this is just, you know, this is affects many families all over the board, and so I think it's really important that we're discussing it here in this venue. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, the two main benefits that we have in our diagrams here is the employment-related daycare, and the other one is the SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, food stamps. Mm-hmm. Those are the two big ones that contribute to that clip. Okay.
I think it would be useful for the committee if we actually understood all those programs separately and the effects of them related to income levels, and then also the people who aren't covered by a proposal like this, whose income is also low. If we're dealing mostly with child care issue, what about individuals or couples that don't have or whose children are older? There may be other issues that don't occur to me right now, but I think it would be wonderful if the governor's office and the LRO could work together to give us a bigger snapshot. I mean, I'm aware as I look at this chart that you still have a gap from $12.10 to $15.10 where income, even with this tax credit, income actually goes down even for those who are eligible for the credit.
Mr. Chair, let me just add one thing on that. We do, as you recall from a bill passed last session, we will be submitting a report to you in February on the tax credits that are due for sunset. The working family credit is, as Vince mentioned, one of the major ones. Chris is preparing that report, and he's been putting in a lot of time, not just on that issue that you mentioned, of trying to get a better understanding, not only the tax expenditures, but the tax expenditures that are related to the actual expenditures. So we're working to try to combine those two things, and I think you'll see some of that in Chris's report when he's finished.
And if I could just simply add to that, when we're dealing with these kinds of issues, we should always include the interaction with the federal tax and benefit system. Now, obviously, the ones you mentioned are at least partly federal, but I mean, in order to get the whole picture, you have to look at all of them. And I like them blown out because that way it gives some of us who like to delve into the details, Representative Vance, a chance to really get down and maybe even come up with other possible solutions.
Chair Barnhart, if I may say one other thing, I appreciate your comments about that this wouldn't include several other needy people that are probably falling into the same issue. And you know, I think one of the things that we were looking at is we examined raising the earned income tax credit by 2%.
in the state. That would have been about a $13 million hit. But it also would have spread out probably amongst, sorry, I have my notes here. I think it's about 250,000 people. But the impact would have been much smaller. This one, I think, affects about 25,000, somewhere between 25 and 30,000 families, this proposal, but would have had a much more significant way to address this particular issue. I'm not sure we would comment one over another, but that's a key element of deciding. This proposal would be $21 million also for the coming biennium.
And if I understood you correctly at your opening remarks, the key issue here is rewarding work and rewarding success with an actual income increase rather than a decrease.
That's correct.
That's sort of the policy behind it all, as I understand it.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you,
I haven't used your name. I now have to let you ask your question. Yes.
Thank you. I apologize.
No, it's not your fault.
And forgive me if you've already addressed this issue, but the in trying to figure out how the EITC works on the one hand versus raising the minimum wage on the other, the challenge appears to be who pays. And whether it's the small employer who has to pay the higher minimum wage across the board or whether it's on the other side of the equation. I don't know if the department is going to provide us with some, I'm sorry, the office is going to provide us with some analysis there, but I've found five or six articles on it and they're inadequate, so I was hoping we could get a better comparison of who bears the burden, the broad group of taxpayers when it comes to a tax credit on the one hand for this kind of a product or the employers if the minimum wage goes up. I mean, those are the choices. You know, I'd like to see that because it's a choice.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, we didn't really weren't necessarily discussing the raising of the minimum wage in this particular concept. Although, I mean, I think we understand there's plenty of conversation going on about that. I think what we're interested in is having a holistic approach to it, that in addition to whatever debate there will be on minimum wage, that we also make sure that we are addressing these issues where as people move up the ladder, whether by a minimum wage increase or just a general increase in their pay, that they also are not penalized, essentially, with their take-home pay with the benefits that are provided to them.
So I had a motive for becoming more familiar with this. I was interviewed by a number of people on this issue, the comparison of the two. And so the challenge appeared to be having a clearer understanding of who pays and how much, and also a part that we talked about the last time we had this discussion, and that is how do we make sure people aren't making a home in this space that we so nicely carve out for them? How do we make sure they're actually moving on through? And so that part is pretty important.
I think we would completely agree.
Yeah, that's the point of this discussion, I think, isn't it? Exactly, yeah. Wonderful. Any other questions for Vince?
No.
Or LRO. Just before you asked your question, Representative Vance, Paul and I were discussing the fact that they have been working on exactly those questions, and we'll have some reports for us in February. Yeah. Thank you. All right. With that, we'll close the information meeting on the awkwardly titled piece, and open one on the initial look at the 1415 property tax collections. If the people are here to talk about those,
Kyle's going to go.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask. Kyle Easton's going to come up from LRO. Just to remind you that Kyle joined us 1st of October. So he's a new economist, replaced Vijay, who left, and Kyle's going to work on property tax, tobacco taxes, and estate taxes. So he's going to give you an overview of what we see in terms of the collections, and then we have a panel of assessors.
So he's going to be extremely busy.
Yes,
this year.
We plan to keep him busy.
Right. Welcome, Kyle. You want to give us an introduction to the
right along. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Paul just mentioned, up next, we do have a look at the property tax figures for the 2014-15 fiscal year. And we've invited a panel of assessors to come join us and discuss what's going on in their specific county. But prior to them coming up, I do have some statewide figures that I wanted to go over before we get into the specific ones on the county. So there, that's on OLIS, labeled statewide property tax trends.
And the actual title is initial look at property tax figures.
Yes. It's a converted PowerPoint, so I apologize. It's a little clunky in how it works. But just to start off, I wanted to show the kind of the overall impose as the first thing. And what we've seen in the year-over-year changes, we're up about 5.1% to roughly $5.5 billion. And you can see there's that's about in line with the trend since Measure 50 in 97, 98. And it's a bit above the 10-year trend, which is at 4.4%. And then down a little bit lower, there's a couple charts that are more over the last 10 years. And you can see the growth has picked up in the last couple of years in 13, 14, and 14, 15. And prior to that, the three fiscal years before that were a little bit down. Or they weren't, it was still growth, but it was lower growth. And this is a reflection of the overall market conditions. And then I also threw in one that I like. It just shows the percentage of property taxes imposed as a percentage of personal income. And we've seen it's been hovering between the 3.6%, and I believe it was around 5% or so back before Measures 5 and 50. So just to give some context of where we are today.
I'm sorry, would you say that last number again?
It was more around the 5% prior to Measures 5 and 50.
Thank you.
So if you go back in the 70s and 80s or so.
Representative Jacob Peterson.
Just a question. Is that total personal income for the whole state?
It is, yes.
Okay, thank you.
So moving on to the next slide, it's just these are the imposed figures for each county throughout the state. So while we do have a 5% or so growth overall, you can see it does vary a bit throughout the state, county by county, and there can be a number of reasons for that. Imposed changes due to market conditions of assessed value, real market values, but also then district taxes. You can think local option levies or bond levies, and a new large bond levy coming in can make growth seem larger, or if one expires, it could drop it down. And that's why there's some variation between the counties there. Mm-hmm. And I should mention before I go any further, these are preliminary numbers. They are subject to change, but the overall trend figures will be fine, but there might be a few tweaks here and there. We received these numbers from the Department of Revenue, and they are preliminary at this point. So I should note that.
The really low numbers, I assume, are closely correlated with economic activity or the lack thereof in those counties?
Mr. Chair, it depends on specific counties and the makeup of their property tax base.
Okay.
There's in some counties it might be heavy on the industrial side, which a lot of times that property is decreasing in value rather than growing over time. And that's, yeah, so there are a few. There's even Gilliam County was down negative 1%, which stood out to me. But then when I looked, and if you go back 4 or 5 years, they're at about double where they were 4 or 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So they have seen some.
So this is catch-up change.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Becca Peterson.
Chair, thank you. And is this the total tax imposed? Does that include, local property tax levies and bonds and all of that included in the total?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Becca Peterson. Okay. Yeah, these. The figures here are district taxes imposed because the numbers were preliminary. So I think I'm missing urban renewal wouldn't be included in these, but that's a pretty small amount. But yes, it is grabbing everything else.
Thanks.
So going to the next slide is compression loss and urban renewal. I put these two figures together. But so compression loss, we remember that's the Measure 5 taxing limits. For example, we have $5 per 1,000 of real market value, or $10 per 1,000 real market value, depending on if it's education or non-education. So general government is generally the way I think of it. But you can see compression loss has picked up a bit in the past few years, which kind of makes sense. It's going almost the opposite of the value of property throughout the state has been going down. And we've seen in this, the initial figures, at least for the 14-15, is we've seen a drop in compression. So it's somewhat in response to the market returning, I guess, growth returning in the real market values of properties. And urban renewal has been fairly steady for the past few years, hovering right about $200, $220 million. And the last one for the value, at least, real market value and assessed values, we can see the trend has been about 3.6, and in this past fiscal year, we're up 8.8% in real market value, so we've seen some return of growth. Where in the chart down below, you can see RMV really did peak in about 08, 09 and has been going down, and it's just now starting to pick back up. And assessed value has been more steady, and that's that difference. As long as RMV is above assessed value, you'll see some growth on property-by-property basis. And I know the assessors have more information on talking about how many properties are assessed at RMV and not. And it's an interesting dynamic, but we're starting to see it go back to what we were experiencing prior to the housing bubble. And then the last slide I have, this is actually a question that we got from a constituent, and they were wondering why their property tax bill increased by about 5%. And I wanted to include it because I think this is something that's happened in the past couple years, if either last year or this year, a number of properties with the return of growth in RMV have experienced, or they can experience, a fairly sharp increase in their taxes billed. And that's what this chart's really showing. This is real data. This is from a constituent that had the question. But you can see RMV kind of growing, peaking in 2008 and then coming down as the market came down.
Right.
But assessed value, the value to which the tax rates are applied, was going up by 3% each year. So the tax bill, the bottom line, was going up by about that same amount. And then looks like it's in 2011 is when RMV actually dips below the assessed value, or the maximum assessed value, I should say, of the property. And so when RMV dips below maximum assessed value, it brings down the assessed value, the value to which the rates are applied. And you can see that in the tax bill also went down. And then it stayed down for the next couple years.
Wow.
And then you see the market start to rebound. RMV jumps back up from about 185,000 or so, 200, now they're at 240,000. And you can see the tax bill can go back up because there's that room under the assessed value to the maximum assessed value. Okay, so you have this correction for 1 year.
You see why they complained.
And but after this, for this property, would go back to, you would expect about 3% assessed value growth. So this correction, if you will, took place, and it should be more consistent.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that point, because I got a lot of... I saw it on my property tax bill, and I got a lot of constituent questions about that as well, seeing a big jump. So this was because it was the very odd circumstance where the real market value actually fell below the assessed value. We see an increase above the 3% that was in property taxes that was then, you know, was supposed to be the maximum in the Constitution. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Chairman,
just to make sure I'm explaining to my constituents correctly. Thank you.
All right.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And it is a lot of times it's going to be a one-time catch-up, mm-hmm. But it can be a bit abrupt for, you can see the constituent.
Session keeps giving.
You can try to point out that the tax bill, if you say steady, gets about there, but it can come as a bit of a shock, certainly.
Yes. The complexities of this property tax system, thanks to Mr. Sizemore, is very, very significant. Of course, Mr. McIntyre as well, or from an earlier time. Right. Other questions for Kyle? Can we go on with it to our panel? Property tax assessors. Gentlemen.
Before beauty, if you want. Presentation. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Vroman, and I'm the assessor and tax collector at Clackamas County. I also have with me, and they'll introduce themselves as well, but Scott Langton from Deschutes County, Tom Rolfing from Marion County. And thank you very much for allowing us to come before you this morning and talk a little bit about the property tax system. I don't know, Kyle, did you copy in this so that it could be projected, or are they just... Okay, and let's look at Clackamas County, if we could.
Yeah, all three of those reports are in our materials.
Very good. The material that I have for you from Clackamas County really reflects what's been happening in the real estate market in 2013, which is reflected for the January 1 values in 2014, and then that is what is reflected on property tax statements that people saw this last fall. And really what it reflects is an improving real estate market. And the tables that follow are going to show you kind of what the impacts of that improving real estate market have had on the property tax system. On the very first table, you can see that in Clackamas County, our real market value increased from $45.9 billion to almost $51 billion, an increase of about 11.13%. The remarkable thing here really is we're coming back, or the real estate market is coming back, but if you look at 2008, we're not back yet, because back in 2008, the total value of all of the real property in Clackamas County was $60 billion. So we're improving, but we're not back to where we were in 2008. If you look at the taxable assessed value, though, you'll see that it's grown, again, relatively consistently, which is what you would expect under Oregon's property tax system. And our taxable assessed value grew from $40.3 billion to $42.3 billion, an increase of almost 4.7%. And then below that, you can see what it looks like graphically, and you can see that it reflects real market values declining, and then in 2013 starting to increase again, and that trend continuing in 2014. The remarkable thing here is if you look at the taxable assessed value, it's grown very consistently. And that was probably, again, one of the stated intents of the sponsors of Measure 50, some predictability and stability in the system. If we could go to the next slide. This one is some information on the number of accounts where real market value actually fell below the maximum assessed value, and in that case, the real market value is what we calculate taxes on. And when that occurs, generally, you're not getting that 3% increase in taxable assessed value that leads to that typical 3% increase in tax. Of course, what Kyle was just explaining is when that has started to go the other way now and real market value is increasing, it in that case, it can increase more than 3%, and you'll see an assessed value growth of more than 3%. And that is, in fact, one of the things that we probably dealt with more this year in our county than we have in past. And that's people that had increases in their tax more than the typical 3%. If we could go to the next slide, please, Kyle. These are the total taxes imposed in Clackamas County, and you'll see that our taxes went from $649 million to $684 million for January 1 of 14, an increase of 5.48%. That, and I think, again, Kyle alluded to this, that's a more typical increase based on what we'd seen in prior years than what we'd seen in the immediate past, and that's also reflected in the table and the level of growth. I think what's important to understand here is assessed value grows really two ways. Assessed value grows because of that statutory increase, the 3%, or that real market value growing. And it also grows as a result of new construction, new property coming into a jurisdiction. You can see in the leaner years when market value was declining, the growth level was significantly smaller. We weren't getting necessarily that 3% increase in assessed value. We didn't have the level of construction that we'd had in a healthier market. If we can go to the next table. This probably was the area that was most remarkable for us this year, and that's compression. Those are the dollars generally that aren't collected when you exceed the Measure 5 limits. And you can see that our compression, our total compression dropped from about $20 million to $13.6 million. So that presents itself as additional revenue to districts that they may not have expected. It also presents itself as a tax increase, often greater than 3%, that a property owner didn't expect. And so we spent a lot of time explaining to people that not just had a real market value that might have been below the maximum assessed value, so they had larger assessed value growth, that usually resulted in having less compression, so they may have gotten an additional increase. Question.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes. Representative Nose.
Is this like a one-time thing that happens, kind of like a correction that's going on with the recession, post-recession, or is this going to happen again and again?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, good question. It generally is something that happens in sort of a progressive fashion. It's not necessarily a one-time situation, because as real market value grows, if it grows in excess of the 3% generally that the assessed value or maximum assessed value grows, at some point you will grow yourself out of compression.
Oh,
but
I did not know that.
But to get there, it may cover several years before that happens. And I have a slide that actually will show that. If we could go to the next one. These are the accounts in Clackamas County that were in compression. Last year, you can see we had 93,423 accounts that had some savings as a result of exceeding the Measure 5 limits.
Wow.
This year, for 114, we had 62,949. So we still have 62,000 accounts that, if our real market values continue to grow in excess of that 3%, that compression will drop, and property owners will see that again as maybe an increase in excess of the typical 3% that they might have expected with Oregon's system.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, please.
I think I'm starting to understand it.
Okay.
So next year when you do this presentation for us, or again, it's going to start to look more like 2008 and 2009 over time. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, as long as real market values continue to grow in excess,
which we're hoping that they
will continue, because that's representative of a healthy market.
Yeah, that's a question for the state economist and the people.
Is he coming here today?
No, he's okay. Not. No.
And then the final slide that I have for you this morning, it's just more of an addition than anything else. If you look at the numbers that Kyle presented on a statewide, his numbers, as he mentioned, didn't include urban renewal dollars. This is our numbers will generally include urban renewal dollars. And I think it's important to understand that most of those urban renewal dollars are going to be collected as property tax anyway. It's just a shift. When you have an urban renewal agency now, generally, that's receiving revenue. So they would actually ultimately be property tax dollars that we collect. In this case, ours is a little bit of shows a little difference because between 2012 and 2013, we actually closed in Clackamas County a major urban renewal plan area, the Clackamas Town Center, and that's why you see that reflected as a decrease in the amount of urban renewal dollars. And thank you very much. I'll wait for questions so that Scott and Tom can tell you about their jurisdictions.
Right, but just one on this topic. What that means, if I understand it correctly, is that more money went into the districts and less money went into urban renewal.
And that is correct, Chair Barnhart.
Thank you.
So good morning. I'm Scott Langton, Deschutes County Assessor. I think statewide, what Bob went over manifested itself fairly consistently. There's going to be different counties that show different, where, boy, what a difference a few years make as far as at least Deschutes County. Pre-recession, we were one of the fastest appreciating counties in the nation. During the recession, we were one of the quickest depreciating. Now we're once again one of the quickest appreciating. Now, what that means and how those peaks and valleys are going to play out into the future, I don't know about you guys. I'm not much of a roller coaster fan, but here we are. If we can go to page 2 of mine, there you can see similar to what Clackamas County is experiencing, but maybe just a little higher and lower valleys there, is a change in market value compared to assessed value, where we've seen quite a appreciation, but we're nowhere near getting back to where we were pre-recession levels.
Yet.
But with that impact, if we can go down to the next. This graph here shows the difference in Measure 5 compression loss. And you can see that, and it broke out, we don't have a lot of tax rates in the government category over $10. There is some impacts, but mainly it's in education. And you can see the amount of compression loss to education districts they experienced during the recession. Now you can see the quick spike up, which is added revenue for those districts and added taxes for individuals. If we can jump to the next page and then scroll down that graph. This graph represents how many of our properties had a market value that was equal to the assessed value, where you can see there in about 2011 and 12, we had half our properties that had a market value lower than the major 53% limited amount, which I don't think anybody even thought could be in the realm of reality or possibilities in 1997. Mm-hmm. With that, though, that had some significant impacts on both property taxpayers and taxing districts, and a lot of volatility with that. Last year, I think you remember I showed our property tax ferry video that we put together as an informational piece to try to help explain how people's assessed value was going up much, much greater than 3% as it went through that. So,
Representative Kelser.
Yeah. So in just in general with all of these slides, is this all compression, including base compression and levy compression, or is this just base compression? So in the base rate, or is this what's lost in local levies for cities and school districts and counties?
As far as the education, we don't, and when you look at education, we don't have any local options, so you're not seeing any of that. That's just the base rate. So those are dollars that the general fund had to backfill, theoretically, now that it's loosening up that amount of that. Because we have, we didn't have the ability for our school districts really to benefit from local options. They wouldn't have received hardly any of the dollars. Did that answer your question?
It does. And is that the same? There's, so when we looked at the, in the initial slide, the total loss of compression change, that's levies and base rate, everything all put together. And one more question, if I may,
please,
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
to help these put together. I know that there wasn't a education levy in Deschutes County, but is there a change at all in the number of levies that are out since that impacts how much is in compression because you're raising that rate? Was that impacting the amount that was lost to compression at all? Do we have fewer or more
changes in levies?
Restrictions with levies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser. I don't know yet because the data is preliminary. We don't have the district level data at this point, so it's hard to know if, yeah, there's fewer that are in compression or not. I mean, hopefully we'll have that later during the regular session. We'll have that like granular data.
And one more question.
Please, yep.
So just looking at yours and looking at Clackamas and skimming ahead to look at Marion County as well, last session we spent a lot of time talking about compression because it seemed like for a number of counties and cities, there was a crisis point around compression loss. With the correction in the economy, has that taken the pressure off general government compression loss and pushed that back to looking at these education compression losses as the bigger loss?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you're going to find varying results around the state. It's going to be very jurisdictional based on that. Overall, as the market recovers, you will grow yourself out of compression. But as we've seen, that can be a very different makeup depending where you're looking.
And just a brief comment on the end of that. I think as you look at this information, I really like to wonk out on compression. It's my favorite thing in all the world. But if you look at these, it continues that same trend for education. Even when the economy is better and home prices are higher, we still have a pretty significant loss in education. And I think that's an issue that we need to continue looking at, not just because of that impact on schools, but all of that that's lost in compression has to be made up from the general fund. So all of this loss in Deschutes County, that's felt in all of our school districts across the state because of the state school fund.
Okay.
So I just hope as this committee, I don't know where I'll be next session in terms of committees, but I hope as this committee looks at compression that it continues to look at the significant impact on education and the state school fund, because that is really where the devastating hits come from. And we don't, even though there's some recovery, if you look at this line here, the general government loss, that line is pretty small up there compared to the education loss that we need to deal with.
Yeah.
Yes. Not that we don't need to deal with general government. I love local government, just to be clear.
Right. Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelzer, just to clarify, Clackamas County's compression does include some levies that are local option levies, and generally in the education category is where most of our compression is. We have very little compression in general government, but a significant amount of that is in a couple of jurisdictions that have a fairly significant local option levy. And we can break that out for you if you would like to have that information, as well as Kyle probably can as well.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Just a quick question for the newbie: is our ability to deal with compression constitutional, or can we actually deal with it?
Representative Nose, it's constitutional.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
You can see why. One of the things that we do every session is look at the complexities of the constitutional rules and what, if any, changes might be available to us. So far,
there's all kinds that are available to
us.
Well, right?
But available includes that the voters
would pass
will
them.
Like them.
Yes, right.
And that's what I mean by available.
That's what people keep telling me about the property taxes.
Right. So please continue. We've been having a general conversation.
Oh. That's what this is for, right?
But, you know, this issue is so complex that the Revenue Committee really needs to focus on it pretty hard in order to even understand the hydraulics and the mechanisms.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's where our association is more than willing to help you out in any way possible on that.
Yeah.
I might address my last slide here, which maybe goes into a little bit of some of that conversation. What I've done here is looked at total taxes imposed to Deschutes County countywide, local options, bonds, everything, because the voters can, of course, add additional taxation on themselves. In certain cases, it has impact in certain cases because of Measure 5, it limits. And then I broke out just K through 12 permanent rate, and you can see the difference there as far as taxes over time. So that doesn't include any of the school bonds or anything. And you're exactly right. This is an incredibly complex situation that each year I try to work in quite a few counts by hand just to make sure that we're doing the system correctly. We use it for staff training, and I check certain accounts, certain that could have some political ramifications to me, such as my mom and dad live in Bend. So I pulled mom's account up. Tax rate stayed the same. Her market value went up 37%.
Wow.
Her maximum assessed value went up slightly less than 1%, and her assessed value went up 3%, but her taxes went up 9%. And, you know, we use that in my staff meeting, and nobody'd be a taker on wanting to call mom and explain that to her. But that's just one of many type things we have to deal with, and it's an interaction of 5 and 50, and it gets so incredibly complex trying to explain it to people. And we spend a lot of our time doing that. So, yeah, if there was a way to simplify the system, I'm sure we'd be all for it.
That comes under filial duty, I think. So it gets to be your job. I think that you may have an error in the scale on that last graph.
Oh, do I?
Unless I've misunderstood the graph. The scale might be millions instead of billions, perhaps.
Oh, is there right?
Oh, you're correct. You're correct.
I mean,
sorry about that.
It's a lucrative tax system in Deschutes County.
It's bad when I make a mistake with numbers. Oops.
Well, and when the psychologist catches them.
No, that's good. That's good. We need proofreaders.
Mr. Chair, may I just comment, because Mr. Langdon is before us, that he is the only property tax assessor on the planet who can actually bring smiles for this committee. Thank you, Mr. Property Tax
Oh, wow.
Yes. Well,
thank you.
Sorry to put a little pressure on the rest of you, but I'm still laughing over the property tax.
Well, assessors and actuaries.
Yeah.
And CPAs, right.
That was one of the best movies ever. I made my kids watch it.
We're not even going to go there.
What movie is this?
The tax movie.
My kids watch Frozen. You watch the property.
You'll be putting on a new one of those, won't you?
What was the movie? Yeah. Representative Gelser.
The property
Kyle will
tax
send you
theory?
The link. Kyle will send you the link.
We will.
Property
will,
tax
because theory. You need to see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great film.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Bestseller.
That it's a YouTube video we put out. It's on our webpage at theshoots.org. It's about 7 minutes.
Okay. That's in my
and
attention rate.
Yes. Yeah.
I've gotten more mileage out of that because I do town hall meetings and seminars for different groups, and I always started off with that. And people have all these questions, and they're gunning for you, and you show that video to start with, and it refocuses. Wait a minute, it's not you, it's the system. And then they start in on the system.
Right. Which, of course, is exactly what you had in mind.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, to get out there and educate people. And that is one thing that, a little bit of a sideline to this, but one thing I'm hearing over and over, and I think a number of my associates are also, is we're back to comparing the inequities between similar houses having very different taxes.
It's a big problem.
And that seems to be a big rub with a lot of people. At least what I'm hearing from.
Right. Representative Nelson.
Just a comment. Until they realize that fixing it means somebody's property taxes are going to go up, like likely theirs. I mean, that's the problem with fixing it. Everybody agrees it's bad until you look at what it's going to do to you.
That's one of the conundrums of this committee.
Yeah, I know. I think Paul Warner explained that to me once in a little bit of outboarding or something.
Are we ready to go on to Marion County?
We are.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart.
Tough
Chair Berger.
To follow. Tough act to follow.
Yes, very tough. And I'm the newbie here, but I tried to put together some similar information to what Scott had put together for his county. And so you'll see some differences.
And for the
again,
record,
I'm
you
Tom
are...
Rolfing, Marion County Assessor. I'm also running the PowerPoint today. Here on our first slide, I apologize. We had M5 here. Which is basically the real market value minus exemptions. And TAV is taxable assessed value. But in this slide, you can see we've seen some increases in the real market value as well from 740 million to 26 billion. 283 million, and our values are, you know, a little bit different. But Measure 5, excuse me, I'm a little nervous here and a little unprepared. Our values have not seen, you know, as much of a change. as Scott certainly, yeah. And our assessed values have climbed fairly steadily, which was the intent of Measure 50. Although the market values did dip down quite a bit in 2012, and they're coming back. We'll look at future screens here that show this one here. Slide shows that. The Measure 5 values the real market values declined quite a bit, and the but now we have more properties that are assessed on there. See, last year we had 43% of our real properties were assessed at their market values, and now we only have 29, almost 30% assessed at their market values. So what that's showing is we have a lot more properties that are receiving the benefit from Measure 50, and less compression. Sorry. Here we've broken it out by property type. We have our real property, our real properties versus our manufactured structures, utilities, and personal property accounts. The business personal property are assessed at 100% of their market value, so they're not receiving any differences with Measure 50. Utility accounts are affected some. We really see the big differences in the real market accounts, real property accounts, the residential and commercial properties. Any questions? Our data is fairly similar to what the other counties in the valley have seen.
Mm-hmm. What I'm aware of is that your variance year to year seems to be quite a bit less than the destination resort that we call Deschutes County.
Very different. Yeah. Very different.
I mean, they're affected by changes in California and other places, and you're affected more by local conditions.
Right, right. We've seen much smaller swings in the value of the property.
Great. Questions? Or for the panel? I think we've asked them pretty much.
It's very interesting.
Really appreciate your making these presentations to us. This is the kind of thing that helps us to understand how the numbers move, and therefore the kinds of things we need to be paying attention to. So I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other things on this topic? This gets us to my final topic that I wanted to talk about. I'll note that we have four members who are leaving or have left already. Representative Conger, Representative Bailey, Representative Gelser, and Representative Berger. And I wanted to... other members may want to do it too, but I wanted to make a couple of comments about these members. Representative Bailey, of course, is already a commissioner in Portland, and I had the opportunity to watch him sitting as a member of the Health Board, which I didn't know existed until I saw that meeting, talking about cigarettes. And he seems to be continuing the same sort of general approach to things that he had when he was on this committee. And I have to say, I'm extremely valuable member, vice chair for the committee. Representative Conger, of course, asked fundamental questions, basic questions about tax policy over the course of the time he was on the committee, and I thought those were extremely valuable for us to have to address those issues. Representative Gelser will soon have a different title, which we'll give her at the appropriate time. And I appreciate that you're the wonk on these property tax issues. I assume you'll continue to be to do that and to be that. And I want to thank you for your service on this committee and in the House. Hopefully, you'll continue that great service in the other body. And finally, for my comments, I wanted to thank Vice Chair Berger, who's been the vice chair or the co-chair for most of the time I've been the chair, maybe all of it. I'm not sure. Representative Berger has been a great colleague, a wonderful friend, working with me as either as co-chair or vice chair with the other vice chairs as we plan the agendas, as we debate what issues the committee ought to consider, as we talk about the appetites of the different caucuses for legislation, which, of course, varies from time to time and issue to issue. And I would dare say that at least as professional colleagues, we've become friends. And I greatly, greatly appreciate your participation in that way. I will tell you that I personally will miss you on this committee very much. I understand why you're moving on, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. While I feel similar kinds of feelings toward the other retiring members, I think they especially apply to you. Aww. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since this is the last time we'll be meeting in this configuration, I wonder if anyone else wants to make any additional comments. Those are the ones that I've felt really compelled to make. This job is hard. It is time-consuming. It is aggravating at times. And I think those who have done it and worked hard on it should get at least a little recognition from the chair. Thank you.
If I can.
Please.
If you'll allow me the last word. I have served 12 years in the legislature. I have been on this committee every session. I just wrote a note over here. We were giggling. You poor tax assessors wondered what we were giggling about. I wrote a note that said that I will not be talking about compression next year. Sorry.
Unless you get experience.
No, I won't be. You go ahead. I've talked about it a lot. It's not on my topic. I have thoroughly enjoyed this work. I never dreamed in my wildest imagining with an interest in education coming off of a school board. I thought economists were crazy. I still kind of think that. I have found that I speak their language. I have found that I speak Phil Barnhart's language. Think about it. But mostly this has been a incredibly positive experience. I have enjoyed to some measure every moment I've spent in this room, but what I really felt in this room is the attitude that we're here to do good policy for the state of Oregon. That's why I'm in this building. Politics gets left outside the door. It enters, but we talk about really difficult and important issues in here, and that's what I've really appreciated. And in closing, I just want to say to Paul Warner and those economists, maybe I will get that degree in economics. Probably not, but you do really fine work, and you make it possible for us to do good work, and it has been a delight and a joy. And I see some people aren't over there, Chris and Mazin, but please, all of you, I have deeply appreciated because we can't work without you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else? Hearing none, see most of you next year. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
Until we exhaust our agenda. Exhaust our agenda.